Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My special guest today is Subanka Banerjee, founder of the climatestorytellers.org, which Subanka describes as a gathering place on the internet for in-depth stories on all things global warming. Subanka is an Indian-born American photographer, writer, and activist. Over the past decade, he's worked tirelessly for the conservation of eco-culturally significant areas of the Arctic and to raise awareness about Indigenous human rights and climate change. His photographs have been exhibited in more than 50 museums and will be shown at the 18th Biennial of Sydney in 2012. He has given more than 100 lectures, including at the United Nations and Columbia, Harvard, Princeton, and Stanford universities. Subanka received a Cultural Freedom Fellowship from the Lannan Foundation, a Greenleaf Artist Award from the UN Environment Programme, National Conservation Awards from the National Wildlife Federation and the Sierra Club, and was named an Arctic Hero by the Alaska Wilderness League. His new book, Arctic Voices, Resistance at the Tipping Point, has just been published by Seven Story Press in New York. Subanka Banerjee, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Thank you, Helen. It's very good to be talking with you again.
Yes. The reason I contacted you this time, Subanka, really was what happened to the Yanomami Indians the other day in the Amazon. And the reason I did that is because years ago, in 1980, I went down from Venezuela down the Orinoco River in a dugout canoe with three men who spoke only Portuguese for 10 days on the Orinoco River right into the Amazon River. And it was just the wildest, most wonderful experience. But as we got deeper and deeper into the jungle, we met more and more Yanomami Indians. Initially, we met them and we'd stop at the side of the river and the tribal leader would come out staggering. He obviously was drunk in Western clothes and there was a church with a cross on it. But the deeper we got into the jungle, we finally came upon a group of stark naked women and children, and the men were out in the boat with spears to get their fish, stark naked and with a dog. And I just tell you this anecdote because it's funny. I was drying my brassieres on the side of the boat. They were sort of Parisian brassieres. And one of the women pointed to them. And so I thought, oh, well. So I gave them one pair. And within about 10 minutes, all the women had tried on that pair of brassieres and it had turned from white to sort of dark brown. And then my son said, come on, Mum, don't be selfish. Let them have it. So I left them a symbol of Western so-called civilization, but it was amazing to see them, and I learned so much about the way they cultivate their land in circles and the way they all live together and the like. And then when I read about this dreadful decimation recently of a tribe by ghastly gold miners, and I read your article, I thought, I've got to interview Subanka again. So Subanka, please describe what happened, why, how, when, and where.
Well, you know, you have been to the Yanomami land and you have met them. I have not. I have actually never been to that part of the country. My work mostly has been with indigenous communities in the Arctic and other parts. But I was actually working on a separate subject on the shelf drilling in the Arctic Ocean, which is impacting the Inupiaq people. And then I came across this news And I knew about the Yonamami. First, I came across probably more than 10, 15 years ago even, through the work of a photojournalist, an artist, Claudia Anduser, who was originally Swiss. Then she moved and started doing this. She gave up her career, like Helen, you did give up your scientific career. I gave up my career. Anduser also, it seems, she gave up her career and got very involved with the Yonamami people. And she started doing this in-depth photo essay work, which was actually shown at the Museum of Modern Art and other places in New York. But anyway, so she was doing that work. And right at the time when the Yonamami land was seeing the first kind of mass destruction, which was building of these roads from the Brazilian government, which led to a lot of destruction as well as brought disease, which is anyway, historically we know that in indigenous communities, outsiders have brought diseases. So that impacted the Yonamami quite a bit. But then in the 80s, something, a whole new thing began to happen when these small gold miners called the Garimpeiros began to move in to make profits. And these are small-scale gold mining. The techniques used are environmentally very destructive. And of course, you know, gold mining leaches mercury and other things to the waterways. So what I understand is within a decade, nearly 20% of the Yonamis got killed for various reasons through these gold miners coming into their country. And then within a short period of time, apparently 40,000 gold miners moved into the Yonamami homeland, which, by the way, is in the intersection of that border region of Venezuela and Brazil.
Yeah.
And so, but there were about 11,000 Yonamami, so there were more gold diggers than Yonamami in their homeland. And that's sort of what I would call the beginning of a resource wars. And there have been over the, since then, smaller scale massacres in their homeland, mainly, again, to uproot them, displace them, to access gold. And there have been resistance as well. But this recent story is quite ghastly, and we don't yet know exactly what's going on and what happened, because as Helen, you mentioned, that it's very remote. Just to get to that area is very remote.
Yeah.
And the other way I also came to know about them, because there is an organization based in London with whom I have just kind of contributed some of my work for their various campaigns, Survival International. They work with indigenous communities all over the world. In fact, they played a role in the establishment of the Yonamami Park, working with Brazilian anthropologist and the Brazilian government. Anyway, so Survival International also put out a press release at the same time that Guardian reported the news story that apparently up to 80 Yonamami were massacred, supposedly in July, and again, presumably by these gold miners from the air. And so this news story came out, and apparently what happened is that it presumably happened in July, and someone came out from the tribe, told the story, and Guardian reported the story, and Survival International gave a bit more in-depth on that. And apparently there were three survivors. What this news story claims is that there were three survivors, and the entire community was wiped out. Now, very interestingly, we just found out that the Venezuelan government did a quick look into the situation, and they are claiming that there was no massacre.
Yes,
so we don't
exactly
know what happened.
Yeah,
there.
I read that yesterday, and I thought, what is going on? Because
the
news was very clear that three men had gone off hunting, and when they got back, their whole village had been destroyed and burnt, and there were bones and charred bodies everywhere. That was the original story. So I don't know why
that
they're changing
right.
it. Yes.
Well, I mean, this is a very quick, by the way, and it's a very quick investigation they have done. So we don't know what will happen. Like there will be a hopefully a thorough investigation and find out, and I'm sure these human rights organizations are saying that Venezuela has not done a proper investigation. So we'll find out in the coming days and weeks what actually happened, because being the remoteness of the area makes it difficult.
Mm.
But you are right, the story was very clear, and there have been past instances of massacre. So we don't exactly know what's going on right
it's
now.
So,
but if it did happen,
yeah.
One of the points I made, if it did happen, and that's when I think the story I was personally interested in, having worked with and working with indigenous communities, is that it is a story of resource war. And one of the points I made in the article is that, first of all, we are consuming natural resources at an unprecedented rate. Our rate of consumption is not going down. It's actually kind of going up. And some of the last remaining resources really left on Earth, natural resources, much of it is in territories where indigenous people inhabit.
Yeah.
And one of the stories I'll relate to, which was I wrote about 2 years ago, one of India's most amazing human rights activists and actually a physician. He and his wife are both physicians, Dr. Binayak Sen, who they dedicated their life to help the underprivileged people after having graduated from the most prestigious university of India. They dedicated their life. And he was working with the, and he has been, he and his wife have been working with the indigenous people of the, what is now called the state of Chhattisgarh. Of course, there is all these natural resource issues. And his work got caught up in the political dialogue because the state wants to open it all up for all these various destructive mining practices. The indigenous people are resisting it. And then there was this whole Naxalite thing got caught up in that because the Naxalites are helping the indigenous people. And Dr. Sen's work got caught up in that, and he was imprisoned. And he was imprisoned for 4 years.
4 years?
For 4 years, there was tremendous protest from human rights groups all across the world. There were vigils happened all over the world. Amnesty International got very involved. There was a tremendous number of articles. And then Dr. Amartya Sen, the Nobel laureate economist, he organized a campaign where some 39 Nobel laureates wrote letter to the Indian government, but nothing was going on. So finally, 2010, and he was behind bars under conditions that his wife described is in a cell of 5 feet by 5 feet, you have two people. They were treating him as, because they charged him with the sedition charges, because they were claiming that he had aided the Naxalites. There was no claim whatsoever on that. And so they put him under the most severe condition. And this is a man who should be given the Nobel Peace Prize. He won the most prestigious one of the... And Helen, you're a physician. You know this. What is that organization called in D.C.?
What?
The International Physicians...
Physician
Society that gave him the highest award.
Yeah.
And he was in jail, and the Indian government did not allow him to even come get his award. But anyway... So last year, finally, and they basically were treating him as the enemy of India. And finally, the Supreme Court intervened, and they got him out on bail. He's still out on bail. They only cleared the sedition charges, but there's all these other charges. So the point that I was trying to make is that, and he's in that article, I made the point that, again, it's about resource wars. He has been working with the indigenous communities all these years for decades, more than 3 decades. And now, of course, the government wants all these resources to extract, and they're doing it in a very unjust manner, and his work got caught up in all that. So similarly, this Yanomami case is caught up in a resource wars issue, and we don't know exactly what's going on. And in the Arctic, the same situation, the Obama administration has been ignoring all of the... warnings from the scientists, from the leading scientists, and moving forward with this Arctic drilling. So the point I was trying to make is that these type of crimes against indigenous communities or underprivileged communities will likely increase significantly in the coming years and decades because the governments and large corporations will go after these resources, and there is not going to be checks and balance unless there is tremendous public outcry. So that's the point I was trying to make.
Right. Well, so we're destroying Indigenous people to reap the last natural resources from the earth so we can maintain this present lifestyle until there's nothing left. There'll be no Indigenous people, there'll be no more natural resources, and we'll just gradually die and fade away and decay like the Roman Empire. I mean, it's inevitable, and it's happening in Australia. You know, Australia's been turned into one gigantic quarry where we've got huge mountains of iron ore and silver and gold and lead and uranium
and coal.
And we're selling coal to China like there's no tomorrow, yes. And there won't be any tomorrow, right. The way we're selling coal. And all they talk about here in Australia is jobs, jobs, jobs and jobs. And it's got nothing to do with jobs because most of the mining now, as much of it, is starting to be computerized. Actually, the trucks being driven by computers and the like. Huge amounts of fossil fuel are used for the mining, but let alone the amount of fossil fuel created when our coal is burned in China to keep the Chinese engine going to produce all the material and stuff that America imbibes. I mean, everywhere you go in America, every shop, everything is made in China. And it's kind of the same in Australia. It's getting to be the same all over the world. We're nuts, aren't we? I mean, we are crazy nuts.
It's unbelievable. It's truly remarkable. In a year, this year, we have seen, and again, last year, the past few years, we are seeing truly like now even the climate deniers, the official climate deniers are coming out. That Berkeley professor, I can't remember his name off of my head, who came out and now is acknowledging that climate change is real. Even the climate deniers are coming out and saying climate change is real. And the things that the scientists had predicted, it's coming out in reality.
Of course.
Whether it's the droughts or the floods or the melting
fires.
Of the ice cap of the polar regions, the forest fires of New Mexico, I lived through that. Last year, you know, I was living in New Mexico in 2010. That year, we broke first, Arizona broke their forest fire record, wildfire record ever. More than 500,000 acres was burnt. Then New Mexico broke their record, and I lived through it, and I wrote a couple of articles about it because our scare was that the New Mexico fire burnt within 3 miles of the Los Alamos National Lab.
Oh, I know. It released plutonium and cesium and everything else into the air, that fire.
Yeah, so that scare. So that happened, so that happened in 2011, not 2010. Then this year, 2012, this summer, New Mexico broke the record that they had broken in 2011. And then Colorado broke their record. So the wildfires of the West has become truly a very, very intense. I mean, West will become probably uninhabitable, the Southwest, within our lifetime. Because the amount of drought and the forest fires is so intense there.
And the forest fires all add to global warming, too, because they're turning wood into CO2. Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, I wrote a book about this in 1991 called If You Love This Planet. And
all the
predictions were there. And I thought, well, I'm so naive. I thought, well, everyone will read this book and they'll stop producing CO2 and everything. But of course, no one read the book. And, you know, and it proceeds unabated. And the problem is, Sabanka, that most politicians are scientifically illiterate. And, you know, they've got their hands in the tills of the corporations. And that leads me to talk about Obama. Look, I mean, I hope Obama wins because Romney's really scary and really dangerous. And behind Romney is Wolfowitz, who's a really evil man, and Karl Rove and others. And Romney's talking about restarting the Cold War with Russia. And building
Iran
and bombing the hell out of Iran, which could kill 2.6 million people in the first 48 hours, according to a study done by Physicians for Social Responsibility. So Romney's nuts, but Obama's a bit nuts too, because you've just very succinctly and beautifully written an article about drilling in the Arctic waters as the Arctic melts. Underneath the Arctic is huge amounts of oil. So what they want, the burning of the oil has created the melting of the Arctic, so then they want to go in and drill the oil in the Arctic that's melting to get more oil out and produce more global warming, and then the melting of the permafrost and the like. So it's a vicious circle or cycle that is going to inevitably lead to the end of most life on Earth. And Obama is going along with it. So would you like to address that issue, Sabanka?
Yeah, in fact, you know, in 2010, I wrote an article pointing out five projects that would practically destroy our Earth. And these are all fossil fuel projects, if these projects move forward. Because the amount of fossil fuels will extract and then burn would be unprecedented. And out of those five was the drilling in the Arctic Ocean, mm-hmm. of course, as you mentioned, and I'll mention the numbers and whatnot, drilling in the Arctic Ocean, and then the coal in the Arctic that almost no Americans knows anything about it. There is 4 trillion ton of bituminous coal in the western Arctic of Alaska.
Oh, my God, equivalent,
equivalent to 4,000 years of U.S. coal consumption. Oh. Right now in the U.S., we consume about 1 billion ton of coal a year. And according to the U.S. Geological Survey estimate, there is up to about 4 trillion tons. So anyway, so it's an enormous amount of coal. I mean, the whole planet will be dead before we burn all that coal.
Yep.
And then the entire tar sands project, one of the most destructive projects on the planet that James Hansen, NASA climate scientist, pointed out that if we develop all of that tar sands oil, it's game over. So anyway, so that's...
Well,
that.
I'm about to go, Sabanka, I'm about to go to Saskatoon to where the coal tar sands are because they want to build small nuclear reactors to boil the tar, the sands,
oh
to extract
God.
The bitumen from it, build nuclear reactors there. And they're calling it, what is clean... Green energy, that's right, green energy, putting nuclear reactors to produce the oil from the sands. Anyway, go on. So we're talking about Arctic drilling, the coal tar sands in Canada. And Canada's one of the most evil countries in the world today. It exports wheat for life and uranium and oil for death. That's what they're doing.
The Harper's government is absolutely horrendous.
Unbelievable.
And these are only five projects in North America. And then the fourth and fifth were, you know, the coal in the southeast and then the deep ocean in the Gulf. What is going on is Obama, basically, I mean, the coal in the Arctic is still difficult to get because of cost. You have to build roads and all that. But all of the other four, Obama is putting his rubber stamp. And that's what is most disturbing, that after all of that protest that Bill McKibben and his organization and others led to stop the Keystone XL pipeline, Obama went ahead and approved the southern half.
What the hell is wrong with Obama? Has he got a cerebral tumor or something? I mean, I don't understand it. He seemed to be a highly intelligent, well-motivated man, and suddenly he's gone nuts.
Well, I think on that I disagree with you. That I know a lot of my friends tell me that he's... I have been a critic of Obama, like, you know, I'm more like Glenn Greenwald, that I'm paying attention to what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that Obama knows exactly, like this Arctic drilling, that I can talk about in depth because this is my project for the last decade I've been working on.
Right.
And what Obama has done is so outrageous. And the question is why?
Yeah.
Is... First of all, he avoided doing an environmental impact statement. The very first thing the National Environmental Policy Act requires, that if there is any doubt that drilling will affect the human community, you will have to do an environmental impact statement. He avoided that completely. There was no environmental impact statement done on shales drilling in the Arctic Ocean. And the drilling in the Arctic Ocean...
Shell, we're talking about the Dutch company, Royal Shell.
Royal Dutch Shell. And Royal Dutch Shell will now, because Obama has given the approval now, finally, after all these years of battle, ignoring all of the warnings by indigenous people, scientists, and the environmentalists. But in a nutshell, here is the situation. So the administration did not do an environmental impact statement, meaning we don't really know what we are going into. Second thing is that nobody, including Shell, they have acknowledged, nobody knows how to clean up an oil spill underneath the Arctic ice. Meaning, and this is Shell has acknowledged this publicly, if there is a spill late in the drilling season, let's say in October, early October or late September, there is a spill, they will be forced to leave the spilled oil in place because there is no way you can actually clean up a spill in underneath the sea ice. And they'll have to leave it in place for 9 months until the next summer drilling season begins and deal with whatever left of the spill. And this is all public record. This is happening. So and the whole the administration is avoiding that. Then their air quality permit that despite the tremendous opposition from the Inupiat people, the Shell will emit a tremendous amount of toxic substances into the Arctic air. The Environmental Protection Agency went ahead and after several lawsuits, went ahead and gave the permit. Now, in July, Shell said they cannot even meet even that diluted air quality permit that was granted to them. And now Obama administration just last week approved that too, that it's okay that Shell cannot meet the air quality permit. So the point is that it is hard to understand why this is going on, but Obama made a decision to take America, and this is a point I have made again and again, to take America toward a fossil fuel-driven future. And there is not a doubt about that. And that's what is so disturbing. That's why every project he is approving, despite tremendous opposition from all of the scientists, the environmental groups. In fact, to tell you, Helen, you will understand this, that if we take a step back, just a few feet back, and look back at all these things, the geologists now have formally termed the geological epoch that we are in, and they're calling it the Anthropocene.
Anthropocene. Yeah, why?
Because the Holocene era in which human civilization flourished has formally ended, and now scientists are calling it the Anthropocene. In simple terms, it means the age of man, where man is causing an unprecedented destruction on the planet. Oh. This is the first year. This is the first year ever anywhere on Earth. The Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Is organizing the first symposium on, the title is called the Anthropocene, Planet Earth in the Age of Man. And I have just been invited to give a lecture there. It's a two-day symposium in October 11th and 12th.
When? This year?
This year, yes, this October.
October 11th yes. and 12th first, at the Smithsonian. 11th and 12th of October at the Smithsonian October. This year. Yes, October. Yes.
And this is the first symposium on the Anthropocene. Scientists are truly scared and worried about. Mm. And this is not just a science conference, by the way. They're bringing in scientists, philosophers, humanists, all across the board, because every branch of Smithsonian is involved in this conference.
Mm.
So this is a multidisciplinary symposium. But the point is that people who have been doing the research and is paying attention are truly worried. Like Hansen has been, like Bill McKibben has been, like you have been. You all have been working on it for decades, and you all have been worried. Now, even the climate deniers are worried. Like, what's his name? I can't remember his name.
Plimer? Ian Plimer? Or there's another one called Lord Monckton, but he's a British guy. No, I can't.
No, this guy is at Berkeley, and his part of his research was funded by the Koch brothers, and he came out and
the Koch brothers, that's this, right. I read about him, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And he wrote this op-ed in the New York Times.
Yes.
Saying he was wrong. Yes. And climate change is real. And the second thing, that it is caused by humans. So, but it's no surprise to any of us.
No.
But even a prominent climate denier acknowledging it shows how worried everybody is, that this is not the time to fiddle around. We have to take a path that would take us away from this But there's absolute,
there's absolutely no evidence, Sabanka, that anybody is doing anything about it. I mean, look at the Republican convention, and then you're going to look at the Democratic convention, and then you look at Congress and the Senate. They are not doing a flaming thing about it. They are fiddling while Rome burns, and Rome happens to be the planet, planetary life, you know?
It is. This time it is the planet.
We should give them all violins.
It's just so ridiculous. Like, it's beyond politics, but the issue is so large. Without governmental intervention, this cannot be dealt with.
That's right.
It isn't just you and I bicycling and eating our tomatoes and potatoes. It's not that level. It's really very serious.
Eating tomatoes and potatoes, that's right, as we bicycle. Yeah, that's right.
Right. It's way beyond that, and something has to happen, but if you look at the policies that are putting in place, whether in the US, whether in India, whether it's in China, anywhere,
or Australia,
they all have all going for the... Because, one thing is that, let me backtrack a little bit. One of the key people, and I think you had him on your program a few years ago perhaps, Michael Clare.
Yes.
The leading resource expert in the US and a dear friend of mine. Michael's latest book came out, called The Race for What's Left, earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's scary because the amount of fossil fuel, like two or three decades ago, we were talking about peak oil. But now the amount of fossil fuel that is left on Earth is gigantic.
Oh, my God.
But it's not the good kind. It's the bad kind, meaning their extraction is more destructive.
It's like tar sands. Yeah. It takes the equivalent of 3 barrels of oil to remove and refine 2 barrels of oil from the coal tar sands in Canada. Three barrels of oil produces 2 barrels of oil. So, you know, just imagine that. Yeah. They're nuts.
And then you're talking about the dangerous, ecologically very dangerous projects like the Arctic drilling or deep water drilling. But anyway, but one thing he pointed out there in that book, which is so disturbing, and public knows nothing about this stuff, is that the big oil companies will collectively spend, and it's all in the books now, collectively spend $387 billion between 2010 and 2014 to move forward with all of these deep offshore drilling projects. How do you fight that?
Well,
$387 billion.
Yeah, I also read that, you know, they're so wealthy because, you know, that they bet on the futures, stock market and trading futures. And so they are incredibly wealthy because they've got all their futures invested in the amount of coal and oil they've recently found. So if they stopped deciding to go ahead, then they would lose all their wealth because all their futures markets would collapse. Do you see?
Exactly. Right. Yeah. It's betting against. Yes, exactly. And you know, in the US, and I'm sure everywhere else, in the US particularly, it has truly become a society run by these big corporations.
Yes.
And especially after the Citizens United.
Yes.
So in a way, Democrats and Republicans, they may differ on a few social issues and whatnot, and there is some variation here and there.
Yeah.
But on the large issues that are crucial for the survival of the planet, they are exactly the same. And that's what is so disturbing.
You know what I feel like doing? Grabbing Obama by the shoulders and shaking him shaking him to wake him up. And that's very dangerous because when you shake a baby, you damage their brain. But, you know, maybe his brain needs to be damaged into a bit of reality. I don't know where the man thinks he is. He's got 2 little children who he adores.
I know.
And
exactly.
loves. I mean, and they've got no future. I mean, I've just been to a conference in Freiburg in Germany where the chairman of the International Energy Association was there, and he just stood up and he said, the way we're going, it's going to be 2 degrees centigrade hotter by 2050, 2 degrees, and by by the end of the century, 4 degrees centigrade hotter.
Oh,
and I've seen some people say 6. Now, that's antithetical to life. We're not going to survive. We are not
going to
survive. And our children and our grandchildren have no future, period. And his children have no future. Have no future.
And that's the point, that he's supposed to be a smart guy.
And
all the top scientific advisors are telling him the things.
Yeah.
And he's ignoring it. Actually, you know, about a month ago or a month and a half ago, I can't remember the exact date, New York Times did an extensive article about this whole Arctic Ocean drilling plan that Obama is doing, which, of course, I've been writing about it for. And what they found in that article is that Obama personally got involved and is fast-tracking this process, which I had been writing, so it was not a surprise to me. But they went ahead and talked with all of these. They put the puzzles together. And he has been personally fast-tracking this. For what reason? For what purpose?
It's like the way he's picking out people to assassinate with drones.
Exactly. Exactly.
New York Times.
And that's what is so disturbing. Like, now when the truth comes out, the truth is actually rather ugly. And you're right. He has two little children. And the scientists are so worried now because, you know, like, Jim Hansen and I are actually doing an event together next February. And he, in his presentations, quite a bit, he shows pictures of his grandchildren.
Yeah, I know that.
And why not? In fact, the title of his book. And you, of course, you have written about it so extensively, the issue of nuclear and the climate change and everything, that what are we doing? Are we nuts or what? But this is what is going on with the politics. And unless there is a citizens' revolt or something, which is in America, it's not possible. Like you, I think at the beginning you just said, in Australia it's all jobs, jobs, jobs. Exactly same here. Jobs, 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 jobs. And it's kind of hard not to say because people are really suffering. In the U.S., a very significant number of people are out of jobs. The young people coming out of colleges are not getting any jobs. Millions of people are really suffering very significantly.
Yeah.
So it is true. But Obama had a chance to start a clean energy revolution, create new jobs, new technologies, new excitement. All that is now lost. And that's what is so sad.
You know what we need?
He had a moment.
Yes, we did. You know what we need is a revolution of scientists. You know, scientists are very cautious. They tend to stay in their labs and they don't put a foot wrong because they might lose their grants for next year and they're publishing papers. But they need to get out in the streets now. They need to really take over because they're the ones that people will listen to. They're like the physicians to a dying planet. And somehow the scientists have to take over now because the misapplication of science, Sabanka, has induced these problems. And so scientists are responsible for what's happening to the planet, and yet they stay in their labs and don't take responsibility but give their new advances to corporations so that they can fill the planet up with 80,000 chemicals in common use every day and it's that sort of thing. Now it's time scientists took responsibility and got out there and said, look, we're guilty. We've done this. Now we've got to fix it. And I think people would listen to them. Do you think so?
Absolutely. You know, like Helen, you did this. You gave up your own career in science and you educated people and became an activist. And you did this. You showed a path. You have inspired probably hundreds and thousands of scientists around the world. No doubt about that. Even though you said people didn't read your book, that's not true. I mean, we all know of your work and we have been inspired by you. And the same thing is that Hansen has been doing. Hansen has gotten arrested in the last 2 years probably 3 times.
Yeah.
Because he goes, he peacefully does the nonviolent protest in D.C. against whatever a coal mine in West Virginia or tar sands, and they arrest him. And he has shown it is possible. Like, scientists, but now more and more scientists are actually coming out. But you are right that science is something society pays attention to. They are credible, and it is necessary that. But time has come. It's a little bit like the point I make. It's a little bit beyond even science now. Like, science, we know what it is. scientists can, of course, come out and tell the truth. We know what it is, but scientists and humanists have to work together to really get the citizens who are basically ill-informed and misinformed to show that, look, your children and grandchildren and everything is at stake here, their future and everything.
Yeah, but then we get back to Sabanka, then we get back to the media and that bloody Murdoch who hails from Australia. I mean, he is the most dangerous man on earth. He really is. He broadcasts to 2/3 of the world's population absolute rubbish. Absolute rubbish. Reality TV, and everyone's sitting there with square eyes, square faces, square brains, imbibing all this ridiculous nonsense. And television has the ability and the potential to educate people about this, like right now. Right now. Yeah, and even Murdoch's got two little girls. I don't know if he loves them or not. Maybe he doesn't. But if he did, you would think that he would use his power and potential to say, for Christ's sake, let's get mobilized and teach the ordinary Mr. and Mrs. Joe Sixpack sitting at home with their kids, feeding them Coke and McDonald's hamburgers and stuff, to teach them what is happening to the planet. And it's so easy to do on television, so easy to do. And it's not just Murdoch, except he sets the tone and he sets the pattern, and all other television stations, NBC, CBS, even NPR, emulate to a degree Murdoch, Murdoch and Fox, you know, because they get such a large viewing audience or listening audience. And somehow that's got to change because, as Marshall McLuhan said, the media is the message, and that's true. And it was Jefferson who said an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. And our democracies, such as they are totally uninformed, I would say that.
Totally
would you say that?
Absolutely uninformed. Exactly. It's a... There is no more news anymore. It's all about entertainment.
Yeah, and who's being, who's murdered and whose blood is where and brains on the footpath and who's being raped. It's about sex and violence. That's what it is.
And, you know, the other thing is that it's so disturbing. Like, just, I think yesterday I read it, or this morning in Truthout, this extensive article, and that's why the ridiculousness when people find out, and you will not read this, of course, in the New York Times, is... it's a very investigative long piece.
Where is it?
This was in Truthout today or yesterday.
Yeah.
Truthout, yeah. Mm-hmm. Today or yesterday, that shows the exact same company with the exact same physical address is doing the entertainment programs for both the Republican National Convention
and
the Democratic National Convention.
Oh, really? Yes. Oh, my God. How pathetic.
So that's what I'm saying, that end of the day, and then there was another one today or yesterday again about the big party that's going on. It's all a big party.
Yeah. Well, it's a charade.
And
the Republican convention was a charade.
Slight variation of things. Yeah. It's a charade, and it's just a slight variation that it's a complete corporate takeover of democracy and complete corporate takeover of future of the planet. And so... how do you fight this now?
Yeah.
And it's such a—it's ridiculous that the same company is actually doing this. Entertainment, they're figuring out where you will go party, what bars you will do. I mean, it's just absolutely horrendous. Same people even. It's the same players.
I mean, it's a comedy, isn't it? It's a comedy. It's a farce.
It's a comedy. It's a serious comedy. Like, it's a serious comedy.
Well, someone clever enough should make a film about it.
Kind of started out laughing. What's going on?
Bloody idiots. That's what I'd say. Bloody idiots. That's what we'd say in Australia. Oh, well.
Well, it's like, but I think now at least there is a reasonable amount of whatever media that is telling the truth, but who knows how many are listening or reading compared to Fox News.
No, they're not.
Very little. Very little.
I think you point out, I'm going to be interviewing after you, Helena Norberg Hodge, who's done a lot of work on microeconomics and everything. But she said, you know, one half of the world's getting fatter and fatter, diabetes, arthritis, heart attacks, strokes, because everyone's eating the wrong food and being fed too much. And the other half is starving. And that's kind of orchestrated too by the corporations who transport food, you know, thousands of miles and the like.
Exactly.
It's just absolutely crazy, isn't it? Every which way you look. We're
every
ranting.
Every which way you look.
Yeah.
Exactly. The transportation of food, most cases, is just an absolute ridiculousness.
Yeah.
Is also requires a tremendous amount of fossil fuel.
That's right.
So they're moving around this enormous amount of food all over with fossil fuels, and there we are. But it's really every which way you look. So we need to connect the dots, but we can't give up. We have to do our work. I think that's the thing. We just have to keep doing our work and just hope that the young generation will pay attention. Or
well, you know what started the Arab Spring was that young fruit seller in Tunisia who was so fed up with the government trying to control his fruit stand that he immolated himself and burned himself to death. And that was a spark that suddenly fired up the whole Arab Spring. And I wonder if there isn't going to be a spark that will fire up or the whole younger generation to say, for God's sake, this is our world, our future. How dare they do this to our planet? And the younger generation take over. And I had great hopes with the Occupy movement, but they've been so intimidated by the ghastly military police tactics that they've sort of retired into obscurity, so to speak. But there must be some way to handle this, don't you think, Sabanka?
There is, Helen. That has not gone away by any means. Yes, there have been ghastly, cruel, criminal military tactics that have been used against the young nonviolent protesters, but that's not going to go away. That, and speaking of the young people, I'll give you one example which was also so disturbing. And he is a really incredibly inspiring, incredibly knowledgeable, incredibly articulate human being. This young student from University of Utah who had very creatively protested. And he and became known as the famous Bidder 70 because the Bush administration, George Bush, at the very 11th hour of his presidency in December, was selling out illegally these leases in Utah, oil and gas leases.
Mm.
And he did something very creative.
Oh, that's right. He bought the land.
Yeah. Tim DeChristopher. And I met him. I came to Santa Fe. I interviewed him. I wrote about him. But anyway, so he... Guess what?
What?
He is in prison right now.
Uh-huh.
Because they tried to put him behind bars for 10 years, but finally, with tremendous amount of shouting from many, many of us, he was still imprisoned completely illegally. Like, imagine this. Tim DeChristopher, a young person who would be and could be and will be able to inspire his generation, is behind bars right now. And these corporate goons and the criminals are having parties at the RNCs and the DNCs. That's what is going on right now. And Tim DeChristopher, truly, because we have heard him speak in person, he's incredibly knowledgeable. He's incredibly, and he's very, very articulate.
So let's get this straight. What did he do?
Okay. So what he did is that, so this lease sale was going on. So he went up. First he thought, and that's why his action was so creative. First he thought that he could protest from the outside because this was going to be an illegal sale or parts of it. And then later, actually, Obama administration did find out illegal sale. But anyway, I'll get to that. But so he was going to do something on the outside. But then just on the spur of the moment, he decided he's going to go inside. And as he entered the room where the lease sale was taking place, the front, whatever, the guard asked him, are you a bidder?
And a bidder,
said, yes,
to buy the land.
Are you
yes.
a bidder?
To buy
like,
the land
you,
like, which had the oil.
Meaning,
yes.
are you going to be buying leases?
Yes.
And he confidently said, yes.
Yeah.
So they gave him a card.
Right.
Bidder 70. That's how he became Bidder 70. And then he kind of bid on various lands and he rose the prices up and whatnot. And at the end of the lease sale, they found out that he was an imposter bidder. Mm-hmm. But and then that lease was cancelled. But he brought attention to the illegality, which later the Obama administration found out that a lot of those leases were, anyway, about a third of the leases were illegal, outright illegal. They were underneath people's homes and whatnot that the Bush administration didn't even know. One third were actually on public lands where leases should not be sold, like national parks and whatnot. These in Utah. And one third were legitimate. So he was trying to bring attention to that, that in the last second they were trying to sell it off. He should be honored and congratulated and actually given an award rather than put behind bars.
Well, it's like nobody, Bradley Manning,
no
isn't it?
No damage was done. No damage was done. Yeah. He didn't do any physical damage to property. He didn't do any of that.
No.
So it was just a lease sale that he showed the ridiculousness and the illegality of the lease sale with a very creative, non-violent, creative action.
Yeah.
It's a very creative action.
It's like Bradley Manning.
Who
released all those tapes and showed the Americans in a helicopter shooting innocent people. That was the start of it. And then it led to WikiLeaks, which led to Julian Assange and the whole thing. I mean, they try and shut people up who are brave and speak out. Luckily,
and creative, and they're shutting them out.
Yes.
No, because you brought up the young people. That's why I brought up Tim DeChristopher's example, because he really is amazing. I mean, he'll be coming out next year, and I'm sure he'll not be quiet. But it's ridiculousness that the Obama administration could have intervened and not put him behind bars, but they went ahead and put him behind bars. And so that's what is going on, is that why? For whose benefit?
Mm-hmm.
Few corporations are benefiting from all of this.
Yeah, well, we need revolution, that's for sure. We need revolution of the young, for the young, by the young, non-bloody, non-violent, Gandhian type,
Dignified, peaceful
revolution. That's what we've got to do. Anyway, look, I'm 74. I don't know how old you are, but we have to keep going, right?
I'm mid-40s.
Look, Sabanka,
we have inspired a lot of people around the world. Oh, well.
Yeah, well, listen, we've reached the end of our time, love. It's been a joy once again to interview you. You're so gorgeous and so inspirational and so full of life and love and vigor. And I thank you so much for appearing again on If You Love This Planet, Sabanka.
Thank you, Helen.
My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Sabanka Banerjee, photographer, environmental activist, and founder of climatestorytellers.org. Wonderful, wonderful man. You're listening to If You Love This Planet, and now we're going to hear an excerpt from a speech that I gave in Vermont at Middlebury College in April 2009. It's about the medical implications of nuclear power, and in particular relating to a very old, dilapidated nuclear reactor called Vermont Yankee, which is built right on the border of Massachusetts and Vermont.
You can't smell radiation. You can't taste it in the food and say, I can taste the radiation in this Hershey's milk bar, chocolate bar, and you can't smell it. It's invisible to the senses. It's really scary stuff. And you know, people at the moment are all talking about costs and stuff, but I tell you what, if Vermont Yankee melts down, there will be pandemonium like there was at Three Mile Island. The doctors knew, and they fled with their families, leaving their patients in the hospitals to fend for themselves. There's a study in this book done by Union of Concerned Scientists about a meltdown at Indian Point, 35 miles from Manhattan. Can you imagine? Well, they've got sirens, and the sirens go, ooh, and everyone realizes, and the radio says there's a meltdown at Indian Point. Where do you go? Well, you rush to the school to pick up your children. You rush to get your spouse, and there's total gridlock on those roads in Westchester, where the wealthy live. Then it flows down if the wind's blowing the right direction towards and hits Manhattan just in less than an hour. The bridges are blocked, the Lincoln Tunnel's blocked, no one can get out, and people get irradiated. Up to 500,000 people could die of acute radiation illness. There's a thing called ground shine. If you get out, the radioactive elements, short-lived, that land on the ground, shine back huge amounts of gamma radiation. You're in a very high radiation field. If you get a very high dose of radiation, your hair drops out, you start bleeding around your gums, you get vomiting and bloody diarrhea, and you die of massive hemorrhage or infection. In fact, at Chernobyl, where the nuclear power industry say only 56 people died, they brought in 600,000 soldiers to clean up the spent fuel rods, which came from, there was a massive explosion, bits of spent fuel rod. If you stand next to one spent fuel rod after it's been in the reactor for a year, you'll get such a dose of radiation, you'll die within days. These men were given buckets and told to go around and pick up these bits of spent in their bare hands. Within a day, they developed what's called nuclear tan. They all turned brown. Their legs and arms swelled so much the skin split, and their head in their brain swelled, and the brain's in a fixed box. There's no room for swelling, so they developed ataxia like drunk people. They got severe headaches, seizures, and they died in 3 days. About 6,000 people have died, but already I think there are more, and many of the others are getting cancer. There's an epidemic of leukemia and children living in the Ukraine and Belarus. There are homes, there's a wonderful film called Chernobyl Heart. There are homes full of deformed children, and my colleagues, pediatricians, said they've never seen anything like it. There's a deficit of wild animals around there because people have been moved out from the environment. Now, cesium lasts 600 years, strontium lasts 600 years, plutonium lasts 500,000 years. There's Europe, and you can see England here. There are farms in Cumbria and in Wales growing lambs whose lambs are so full of cesium 137 they can't sell them on the market. They send them to paddocks, fields where there is less cesium to sort of dilute the cesium, but they're still radioactive. 40%, and you can see that, of the European landmass is still radioactive and will be for hundreds of years.
This is Helen Caldicott. And that was a lecture I gave at Middlebury College in Vermont in April 2009 about the medical implications of nuclear power. Please listen again next week for another exciting, stimulating, provocative program from If You Love This Planet. If you want to go back and check other programs, go to ifyoulovethisplanet.org. And if you want to help us and help pay for our production and the producer sitting beside me, Jasmine Williams, I'd be incredibly grateful if you pressed the donate now button and helped. So that's all for today. We'll be back with you next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.